I'm hearing, I believe, is that much of the, as you said, much of the intent of independence has been met. The words that call for direct line authority are not part of the solution that has provided that that independence that is different than what we had prior to Columbia.
That's a very good way to put it.
Dick, could I add a little something here? Joe made a statement about the safety organization being responsible for safety. It might be a little imprecise to say that. What we're trying to make sure is that the line organization program manager has the responsibility for safety. The safety organization has responsibility for safety oversight and independent assessment. And we feel that the arrangement that NASA has put together is the best arrangement for keeping the safety responsibility in the line and keeping the safety oversight and independence responsibility, you know, as part of the safety organization. So it's a compromise solution that keeps the proper balance and the proper healthy tension between those organizations.
Thank you.
But in reality, safety is everybody's job, okay?
Any other questions, discussion? Back to you, Dan.
We'll turn to the last piece of 911, which is Recommendation 753, reorganize the Space Shuttle Integration Office to make it capable of integrating all elements, including the orbiter. The genesis of this recommendation, for those of you who have not looked at the CABE report, was pretty obvious. That is, the instant issue of foam shedding from the tank. At the time, at least, of the Columbia accident, no one was paying, not enough people were paying sufficient attention to the history of foam and the damage that it had done in the past. And the characterization in the CABE report is probably an overstatement, as I'm inclined to make as well, that the shuttle or the orbiter folks thought that the foam shedding was a tank problem, and the tank folks thought that it was an orbiter problem because it was only doing damage and causing some maintenance problems but not doing anything critical. And so there was a never-the-twain-shall-meet problem of not enough discussion between the tank and the orbiter folks, and not an acceptance of responsibility and a joint responsibility at that to analyze the issue of debris and to begin to assess what could be done about it. And so the CABE said we need to reinvigorate systems engineering, which in their view had been let to diminish over time. NASA's response here was very fast. The program appointed a head of systems engineering who began to hire almost immediately, although having trouble at first finding the kinds of folks he wanted, but has played a critical role, an elemental role, in return to flight. They have taken charge of the entire process, review process, leading up to return to flight through the design certification review process. SENIO is responsible for the extensive analytical modeling that has been undertaken since Columbia, and again in response to the CABE's report, in which there was not sufficient or robust enough models available. And so in many, if not most, ways, NASA has implemented the literal words of this interpretation. It's been reorganized. There is an SENIO office. It is quite robust. It is well, at least in numbers, certainly well-manned at this point, and very active in all aspects of return to flight. We are particularly noted that they have done a great deal of work on invigorating integrative and integration processes as well. As you see in the last part of this slide, reorganized and revitalized the integrated control board, integration control board. Again, it was part of the organization that had been let to languish, but the ICB now has to sign off on all of the integrated requirements, waivers, and other things that have happened between the elements. So there's been a lot of work done on integration. The one hesitation we have here to a full endorsement of what has happened, is that there's been some failures or less than stellar efforts in parts of systems engineering piece of this. And some of my colleagues have said that that's more than understandable for lots of reasons, including the fact that NASA was largely, the engineering functions were working on, in quotes, operational vehicle, and that, in fact, that what was required after the accident was more developmental kinds of engineering efforts. And so some of the weaknesses we've witnessed are, were inherent in trying to use an operational organization to do developmental work and the kind of evolution of one to the other. So with that in mind, I think there were areas that we see that need continued development and improvement. So we would say that the in the overall scheme of things, there needs to be continued attention to the systems engineering aspects of the SEIO reorganization. But again, here we would say that they have certainly met the intent of CABE. The literal words of create an SEIO office has certainly been done, and there's been a lot of terrific work done here as well. So we would say, Mr. Chairman, that the intent of 753 as a subcomponent would have been it has been met by NASA in many ways, and that the SEIO efforts have contributed greatly to the return to flight.
Questions, comments? One thing we and clearly in a lot of our activities we've seen the involvement of the new SEIO organization in looking at those actions that the agency's taken relative to CABE recommendations. Have they effectively been involved in what I'll say non-CABE areas that require the participation and of the SEI function that we've been able to make any read on?
I'll let others predict that. My guess is the technical panel has seen this as much or more than we have. My guess is, frankly, and it is only a guess, that the SEIO office has been involved probably less with CABE-related activities in some sense and more with the ongoing activities of getting the orbiter ready to fly. They have a list that started out as the top 10 list, I guess. It's called the top X list. And has more than 10 items on it most days, but that are program-wide issues that they're working. And often when I looked at the list, you couldn't trace them directly necessarily back to CABE activities. Clearly a lot of the work being done on analytical modeling and debris is a result of technical recommendations and organizational change, but a lot of their work has been outside the area of direct CABE-related activities as well. I think they affect much more than what we have been looking at and spend, my guess is, more of their time doing those other things than CABE-related activities. But I leave it to my colleagues to fill that in.
Mr. Chairman, the most notable example of this is the recent activity which occurred during the tanking test, on tanking test one and the subsequent tanking test, in which a number of repress cycles were noted. Following that activity, the SEIO organization took the lead in pulling that activity together and driving that down to isolate the source of that particular event occurring. They've also been active in a number of areas where there have been areas of contamination noted in various types of fuel inlets to the SSME, and they've been active in isolating those causes and dispositioning those causes. So they've been very robust in areas outside of those comments which were contained in the CABE report. They're very actively involved in elements of the ongoing technical review of the other parts of the shuttle which were not directly related to the Columbia accident.
We may not have focused much on their performance in those areas as we have because of our direct relationship with the CABE activities. Have we seen enough to draw any judgments relative to that? We say that weaknesses remain in systems engineering function and processes, and I guess is that based upon what we've seen relative to their dealing with the CABE recommendation areas, debris and transport and damage and tolerance, or is it on other areas too?
Yeah, I think we've seen an integration across several centers of the system integration and system engineering job that's impressive on other problems other than CABE, and the fact that they pulled together the other parts of the manned space activity, Kennedy and Marshall, to do integrated solutions to problems, which is one of the things that I think was at the heart of the CABE critique.
Other questions? Okay. Dan?
With that, Mr. Chairman, I will try to end where we started, which is to say that 911, which is the return-to-flight recommendation, says that a detailed plan should be produced. NASA has not only produced a detailed plan, a robust plan, it has gone far beyond that and implemented much of what we've discussed this morning. As with any of these recommendations, it will take a continuing effort and vigilance to see that they not only have reorganized, but the reorganization is working in a way that would allow the organization to know more about safety and to know more about its technical rigor than it did before Columbia. So it will take further vigilance by others inside and outside of NASA to make sure that these changes are permanent, because there are frankly still tensions, as you would guess, to organizational change. There are tensions inside NASA that would, I think we've heard the words, snap back the organization, or at least its operations, to what it was pre-Columbia once the attention is diminished post-return to flight. So this will take continued vigilance, as with everything else we discuss, but nonetheless, we would recommend to the task group to say that recommendation 911 and the intent of CABE has been fully met.
Okay, I do have one more question. Relative to the ongoing implementation of 75, 1, 2, and 3, we have a established relationship with the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel in identifying those things that we believe that were CABE recommendations that either were return to flight that may have continuing actions or were not return to flight, but we, in which in this particular case these were not identified as return to flight, but we've taken a look at. Are these some that we would expect to transition a continued assessment of successful implementation over to the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel?
It's a very good point you raised, Mr. Chairman, and I should have mentioned it, that in fact it's anticipated that certainly 751 and 752 are fodder for that the section we hope to have in a report that will pass things off formally to follow-on organizations. In fact, ASAP has been briefed several times on the ITA structure, its implementation, and issued actually a statement on that they thought it was an appropriate structure. And so they already have a knowledge about what's happening and, if you will, a buy-in as to that structure. And I think we'll be quite amenable in some ways to continuing to monitor how ITA evolves at NASA. So you're right on the point, is this is an appropriate thing to pass on, and, in fact, ASAP anticipates already taking it on.
And I think you'll also find that they have very keen interest, ASAP does, in terms of system engineering and the processes by which that it works within the organization. So they may take an interest as well. And 753, just if nothing else, is for a maturing model for the agency as it moves into other and different program areas.
At this juncture, then, it's very important to note that the management panel has finished its work. We set that standard for the rest of you.
You had an easy job.
I would like to commend the management panel for the diligence and approach that you have taken toward addressing all of these recommendations, clearly outside the technical world, but touching the technical world. And I know you all have worked these hard and long, and your fact-finding and deliberations, our preparation for these deliberations and coming here. So I thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In starting out, the operations panel has worked on seven of the CABE return to flight recommendations, and the seven recommendations are up here on this slide. I'd like to say that three of those recommendations, which have red closures on them, have been closed at previous sessions. A couple of those had conditions associated on them, were closed completely subsequent to the December plenary. Three, four, one, which was a ground-based imagery one, the first one on the list there, was conditionally closed in September, and we will be presenting that recommendation here today for complete closure. With our recommendation for complete closure, as well as 343, the high-resolution imagery recommendation. We will additionally be presenting SSP-3, which was not a CABE recommendation. Rather, it was a shuttle program raise the bar effort in order to provide contingency shuttle crew support and crew rescue in the event that the primary risk mitigating efforts of preventing debris and protecting the orbiter through hardening efforts and imagery and characterization of damage states and fixer repair efforts, in the event that all of those primary efforts failed, this was a last ditch contingency effort that the shuttle program thought prudent, and the CABE alluded to in their report, but didn't make a specific recommendation for. We'll be discussing that one. And then finally, we'll be giving you a status on the thermal protection system inspection and repair recommendation 641, which we have worked in conjunction with the technical panel. So without any further background, let me turn the floor over to Mr. Bob Seek, who will discuss the imagery recommendations 341 and 343.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Next chart. This is a recommendation. The investigation board noted that the lack of imagery certainly hampered the investigation process from the Columbia accident. So accordingly, they made the recommendation to upgrade the imagery system to give more useful information on the performance of the shuttle, in keeping with the fact that it's a developmental vehicle. It's not totally instrumented, and there's some aspects of its performance that you've got to use imagery to capture, and that was certainly lacking in the case of Columbia. There had been ground camera sites over the years that were allowed to deteriorate, is the best way to put it, because of lack of requirements and funding. There wasn't a need. The program didn't see the need to capture that data. So the recommendation was to turn that around, provide useful imagery and take that all the way up to solid rocket booster separation, and so that this doesn't erode in the future, make it part of the launch decision process, add it to the launch commit criteria or appropriate requirements document, and consider using some other capabilities like ships or airborne aircraft to, again, enhance this capability. The next chart goes back to why we conditionally closed this earlier. NASA has and had already invested, since the accident, considerable resources in upgrading the capability. They've added some new sites. They activated some old sites. And they now have two aircraft, high-altitude aircraft, that will be available during launch to capture their performance of the shuttle. And on the ground camera sites, they've added high-definition television to a number of them, and that will enhance the quick-look process because they'll get that information essentially real-time as opposed to waiting for the film to be developed. This capability has been exercised not only in simulations, but given that a lot of these assets are jointly used, they're a combination of Air Force range, contractor owned and operated, as well as NASA owned and operated. So they've been used in expendable vehicle launches since the Columbia accident, which has given a good indication of their performance, as well as training the operators for the manually controlled trackers. So, again, going back to December, as far as the site preparation is concerned, this was and is essentially complete for the Columbia launch. If you go to the next chart, the reason we deferred full closure of this was because the requirements weren't baselined yet, which was another feature of the investigation board recommendation. And they were outlined in our open request for information. We wanted to see the technical requirements for the cameras, their capability, and what aspect of shuttle performance they captured. We wanted those documented somewhere. And also the reporting protocols, should any of these camera sites not be fully mission capable at time of launch, we wanted that to be reported as status to the mission management team so it could be a consideration in the launch decision process. And that was why we didn't fully close this based on the effort they'd already expended earlier in the year. The next chart. They did take care of that documentation and requirements. They're in what's called the program requirements document, which in NASA terms is a level 3 document. But all of the performance characteristic of all of the cameras are now in that document. There's also a good description in there as to what capability you would lose should that particular camera site not be available during the launch. The launch procedure itself now contains the protocol for the various owners and operators of these camera sites to report back their status, and this goes all the way back to weeks before launch at the launch readiness review and then the subsequent flight readiness review. The launch minus 2-day review, the tanking meeting, as well as all the way into the launch count down to 20 minutes. So that's embedded in there. And as far as a launch commit criteria requirement is concerned, the cameras that are inside the pad perimeter, they added a backup power system for those, and that is part of the launch commit criteria because in the past, if that system for some reason was not operational, we would lose all of the imagery capability of the short-range cameras. So they added a redundant backup power system to the power supplies, and that's now part of the launch commit criteria document per se. So next chart. We felt they've certainly met the intent of this recommendation. They put a lot of effort into it. If you go to the final chart and observations, two observations to make. One, the investigation board recommendation wording said put it in the launch commit criteria. Well, that's a specific document that has all of the criticality one systems and ramifications if they're not available for launch. This is not a criticality one system. Their intent was to make it part of the launch decision process. They accomplished that intent by putting it in this other requirements document as well as embedding it in the operational procedure for launch countdown. So they met, we feel they met that, the intent of that. The other is, gets back to what the board said is in treating the shuttle as a developmental vehicle. And considering what the program has invested in this and looking at the history, the legacy of how these ground camera sites and the interest in their the performance of the vehicle deteriorated over the years, we would observe that this is going to be a candidate for future scrubs and budget cuts, and they should, as a recommendation, although it's probably not within our purview to do that, but it would be prudent to keep this capability for the life of the program. And again, going back to the previous chart, we certainly feel they've met the intent of this, and we're submitting it for full closure.
This is one of those systems, Bob, where when everything's working right, it's hard to remember why you need it.
Well, that's right.
And that's the risk, I think, that you're pointing out in your observation.
Yes.
Result of this removal of the condition here. Yes, go ahead.
I have one, which is, and you may have addressed this, Bob, or the reports have, which of these capabilities do we have planned now to discontinue after the first two test flights? Or that's the other way, which will continue after the first two test flights?
Well, the ground camera assets are planned to continue right now. The airborne aircraft, considering the cost of leasing those, they're a candidate to go away after the first two flights. And, of course, the feature they provide is if you had cloud cover that was acceptable to fly through, although you would lose some of the imagery from the ground sites due to the cloud cover, they could capture their performance above that cloud cover. And that's why they're useful, of course.
But at the moment, all of the other the new onboard capabilities, it's anticipated, won't be continued through the program.
Oh, no. I'm going to get to the onboard ones next, but the ground ones, yes, they're planned to be part of the repertoire for the duration.
Other?
Again, as part of the capture the performance of the vehicle initiative that the investigation board wanted the program to undertake, and this one is for the onboard capability. The recommendation is to provide and the information to the decision makers and to give you high resolution imagery, so you can make decisions as to whether or not any debris that was liberated caused the kind of damage to the orbiter thermal protection system that you would want to fix or at least disposition before you made the decision to reenter. The next chart, the major change that the program did to implement this requirement was to add the boom, the orbiter boom sensor system to the shuttle. This is a significant modification to the orbiter. It's a very sophisticated system in terms of the amount of effort put in return to flight activity. This is probably right up there with the modifications made to the external tank. It's a significant change to the orbiter, hardware-wise, and a significant change to the management, as it were, of the flight itself. The primary purpose for this boom is to provide imagery of the underside of the orbiter, specifically the leading edges of the wings and the apex and the underneath areas of the RCC panels on the wings. The management of the data and the information will be talked about later in a later recommendation, but the purpose of this is to capture the potential for any damage on the orbiter that you need to do something about before you make the decision to reenter. In addition to the boom system, they added some cameras, two of them, to the solid rocket boosters that will look at the external tank, inner tank area during ascent, and those cameras will be retrieved from the solid rocket boosters post-flight. In addition, they added a camera which has already flown before to the external tank, and it'll get a very broad view, not high resolution, but a broad view of the underside of the orbiter all the way through external tank separation, and that information will be provided in real time. And this, again, is supplemental information to help make decisions on orbit with the refined data that you will hopefully get from the boom. Next chart, the boom has two sensor packages that essentially we're relying on to give us this high-resolution imagery. The first one is what's called the laser dynamic range imager. It's an instrument which gives you two-dimensional as well as three-dimensional characteristics. And the secondary package, we'll call it, is a camera system. And it will give us a better view of the areas around the nose cap because of its wider range of visibility. The resolution of these packages is an ongoing activity. In the laboratory, you can see the numbers up there. You're down to thousandths of an inch resolution, and that's excellent. I mean, and that certainly falls in the category of high resolution. The issue, of course, if there is one, is, well, is there, will it capture that kind of resolution when you're on orbit and the lighting isn't going to be as perfect as laboratory conditions and you're on the end of the boom and it may be moving a little bit? And that remains to be seen. But certainly, as far as the laboratory tests on the ground are concerned, it falls in the definition of high resolution. And as you can see by the numbers, quarter-inch loss of surface coating, 15,000th inch cracks and holes down to a quarter of an inch and maybe below. They're still doing testing on this. Is going to be excellent data for the team. Since this is a very sophisticated system like the remote manipulator system on the orbiter, there's a lot of operational techniques that have to be refined to make sure that you can get to all the areas that you want to view and it'll be able to see what you want to see. So it has a sophisticated software package. There's a lot of training associated with this with the flight crew, and that work is ongoing. The real performance of this will not be known until it's used on orbit, is the bottom line on that. Now, the boom is primarily to capture the high resolution on the reusable carbon-carbon, the reinforced carbon-carbon panels. The tile on the orbiter, being more forgiving for damage, will essentially be mapped from the space station with the cameras that are available on the space station. And if they cannot get good views from the space station with those cameras, they again can use the boom to access most of the vehicle underside of the orbiter for tile damage. But the primary method will be the space station cameras.
Bob, it's probably also valuable to point out here that we have a kind of a pointing mechanism for this thing, too, that we've got the wing leading edge sensors, impact sensors, that if an event does occur on the reinforced carbon-carbon, we'll give them some idea of where to go look. So it'll focus this. They'll be able to focus this activity.
And that all falls into this integrated data gathering process, which would include the ground cameras, the tank cameras, and the SRB cameras. That's all put together in an integrated package that Susan alluded to in the orbiter inspection plan. One piece of data complements the other, and this is going to be a significant data gathering and data analysis activity once this imagery is received in real time for the to get it into an informational form as opposed to just data, and get it in the hands of the decision makers so they can decide what either needs further review or potentially repair.
And this is one of the areas when I was talking about with the MMT. Not only do you have just reams of data that will be coming in that the MMT folks have never had to put together and see before, but it's entirely possible that once you've opened up this magnifying glass that you're going to end up seeing what looks like it could be way more damage than we ever imagined. We don't know what the leading edge looks like on orbit. We've never looked at it before. And so those decisions are going to be really interesting, and that's why I pointed out that I thought that the having those discussions was an important part of the MMT because it puts together all of these data. Now, when you look in a really large mirror in a, you better be prepared to see blemishes and know what to do with that.
And I know we're going to are planning on hearing from the IBASP one more time at our last public session, but I guess from the standpoint of the OIP, is it robust enough to deal with just what you're talking about, the fact that we're going to get data that in volumes and from sources that we have not been able to previously simulate even to a degree of what we'll have when they actually fly?
I think everything that I have certainly, my interpretation of what I've seen from the MMT's SIMS and the MERS SIMS and talking to people looking at that document is that it is, in fact, robust enough to handle this, but we really and truly won't know that until we go and see it in action.
I think it's gone through a number of different drafts, and it's certainly improved with each draft. It's a fairly detailed document. There's two aspects to reference, though. It predominantly just focuses on imagery and inspection, and obviously if you're going through these critical decision-making processes and you've got feeders and timelines, then you have to ensure there's sort of seamless transition and also keeping your eye on all the options between repair and then CSCS and launch on need. And I know that they've been working to make those areas more robust, and that's what I was discussing earlier when I was just talking about the MMT, that they need to continue to develop their framework for these integrated risk versus risk trades, and because there'll be new aspects and complex aspects that will continually feed in. The other issue for the current version of the Operation Integration Plan for TPS assessment is that it is based on current data, and should that data change between now and return to flight, obviously it will need to be updated, and the MMT will have to be well aware that it's been updated so that they are reflecting that latest information. That processes are in place to do that. The teams will know, but it's just a comment I make.
Okay, next chart. As I mentioned, this is a complex system, and there's still some additional work they need to get through to fully certify that it's ready to go fly. To get this articulating arm around all the payload bay doors and other protuberances that are out there, in order to get right up to a particular wing leading edge panel, there's clearance issues that have to be resolved. They've they've got a number of documents, programs. They have to address things like this, like the clearance issues, and they've got to get through all that work documentation as part of their prepare for launch process, as well as the standard system acceptance reviews. But that is the plan to do that, and we have full expectations that they will get through that. There's no doubt that is the program plan to fly this boom and use the imagery from it. That's and as far as we're concerned, they're on the process to do that. Next chart. So we felt they've met the intent of the recommendation. This boom sensor system will certainly provide high resolution imagery. On the next chart, I have an observation that there's still this unknown as to whether or not what you've duplicated in laboratory conditions can be duplicated on orbit, with the reality of the nuances that you face when you're operating in zero G with different lighting and the other dynamics with the shuttle.
To that end, though, it's important to remember that all of the imagery and wing leading edge operations Bob's talked about are intended as focusing mechanisms to be able to go out and take a closer look, so that it's in the flight plan to have an opportunity to go back and say, we think we saw something, we better have a closer look at it. Doesn't solve the problem entirely, but it really helps increase the chances of actually picking up damage that has occurred.
Bob, at some point, too, you might want just to reference sort of the future of the boom or OBSS. Clearly, at some point, because of other payload requirements, it will not be able to be used long-term, but I know NASA wants to retain that capability.
Right, and that was, of course, Dan's question. The boom is as you get further down the road in space station assembly, it's planned to take the boom off. I'm not sure which mission it goes away on, but this is not a forever life a shuttle manifested item, because there are some station missions where you can't fly this. You need the payload bay access for other space station components.
It's not an ideal operational solution either, because it takes an entire flight day to do this scan. So, I mean, ultimately, they really do need to come up with another solution.
And I believe they have a roadmap try to get from here to there, so that they would have a solution that would take, you know, perform these capabilities when the boom can no longer be used.
So back to the recommendation chart, we finished our assessment on this. Of course, we're going to watch the completion of the forward work with the proviso that will be completed. We feel the intent's been made and recommend closure.
Okay, any additional questions? The idea, I think, underlying the discussion we just had was the idea that there is a plan that to continue to develop capabilities for on-orbit imagery, be it the OBSS or alternatives, beyond the time that you can actually carry OBSS up on the shuttle, including basing it at the station or using other means to accomplish the same. But for return to flight and in terms of 343, OBSS is the primary mechanism for accomplishing the required imagery of the RCC leading edges and nose cone areas, I guess. Is that right? Yeah, okay. Any other questions, clarifications? Unless there's an objection, I'll recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA, the ops panel's presentation, our deliberation today, that the record will reflect it, that the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of 343-1 and accepts NASA's request for closure of our work in this area.
And that completes the closure packages for all three of the related imagery recommendations by the ops panel. And now I'd like to turn the floor over to Brigadier General Select Susan Helms for discussion of the contingency crew support CSCS SSP-3.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. I know we've talked about this in numerous public sessions, but after Columbia, it was an obvious question that everybody asked, which was, hey, if you could get to the space station, could you buy some time in order to keep the crew alive until you could foster a rescue or, not in the case of Columbia, but perhaps in some other scenarios, a repair? So when NASA began to look at the overall risk picture as they proceeded toward return to flight, next slide, it turned out that the ability to actually leverage the space station as a safe haven began to come into the site picture when considering residual risk mitigations. Our rationale for assessing SSB-3 are related to these bullets. It was not required by the CAPE for return to flight, but on a couple of occasions throughout the report, they did mention that it would be a prudent thing to address. And then as NASA began a review through Nancy Curry's process of their overall risk picture, it did play as one of the final risk mitigation factors that was something worthy of discussion and evaluation. So when they made the commitment to have a rescue shuttle available in the event that they might actually find themselves in this scenario, I think we all agree that the actual case of going to a CSCS scenario is extremely low risk, but once NASA made the decision to actually plan to have a rescue vehicle in place for the first two missions while we were going through the verification and validation of tank modifications as a primary risk hazard control, we decided to go ahead and look at that to make sure that the plan was synchronized. Next slide. The implementation plan for SSP-3, when NASA laid out their thoughts and their plans for how they would go about doing this, these are the top-level summary points that they had in mind to pursue it only as an emergency contingency capability. They're going to look at current shuttle and ISS support capabilities for crew rescue during a CSCS situation, the evaluation of the ISS fault tolerance requirements for CSCS. What's that? What that's speaking to there is it the kind of situation where you might need to make sure you have perhaps some additional spares on board so that the CSCS plan wouldn't fall apart in the case of perhaps the failure of a critical item. They also were looking at consumables management to make sure they had all the necessary things that they needed, oxygen, carbon dioxide removal, water, food, things of that nature. That was part of the plan. And then finally, if it did turn out that they wanted to increase the margin of protection as far as risk, what additional logistics would they actually manifest on the shuttle in order to get to that point? But this was their plan, and we were not looking at this plan with respect to whether or not it met CAPE intent, because there was never an RTF recommendation related to this. But through the process of evaluating SSP-3, we came up with basically five criteria of evaluation, which I'll show on the next slide. Looking at their plan, we were looking at basically a measurement of how they did against their own plan. And another aspect of this was to look at their consistency as to how they applied their plan across the board in many areas. So these five conditions that we set up were the ones that we used for all of our data calls as well as our ultimate assessment of SSP-3. Number one, the explanation of how CSCS plays a role in NASA's risk management framework. Initially, it was unclear to us whether or not it was closer to something more of a substantial hazard control or whether it was just kind of a Hail Mary approach. And we needed some clearer definition of that. And Nancy Curry's risk framework provided an outstanding method by which we could understand where CSCS actually ultimately fell in NASA's overall risk picture and how they defined it. Number two, a dynamic, robust analytic process. When you're talking about the duration of how long a crew could be on board, what we were after here was looking into their estimates for the duration and how they came up with the assumptions and the analytical process for that duration. It turned out that once you say you're going to have a rescue shuttle in place and that shuttle will be available to be launched within some period of time, we were interested in making sure that the CSCS capability, the safe haven duration capability to support nine people, actually supported those number of days up to the point where the rescue shuttle could arrive. So our condition there for number two was really to make sure that that evaluation for those number of days of waiting had some teeth to them, and it wasn't just something that was pulled out of the air. And that we have a very good news story in that respect. The third condition was that you did have a viable plan for launching a rescue shuttle. This certainly was a fairly easy one to verify because, obviously, we launch shuttles. We have launched shuttles so many times. There were a couple of unique twists to actually fostering a rescue, though, probably the prime one being how do you actually undock and deorbit the damaged shuttle in the process of bringing up the rescue shuttle. So in the broad scope of things, the condition number three there, we were pretty confident that that was already met, but there were a couple of nuances to that that we wanted to verify. Number four, the appropriate integration of CSCS into the launch decision process. The space station program does have an overall role in participating in shuttle launch processes to go to the ISS, but what wasn't in a process at all was how you folded in the CSCS duration aspects to those launch processes. So we were just looking at where and how NASA was going to take those points of synergy to make sure that the story was consistently applied between the two programs so that both of them understood what the overall requirements picture was through the process of counting down to STS-114. And then finally,
Susan,
yes, sir.
Could I interject one thing there? It's important for clarification, I think, to note that CSCS duration capability is a dynamic thing. It varies day to day, and it will change right down to the FRR, and that's why we needed to be sure that we had that capability to update it as late as the FRR.
Right. I have a slide that actually talks to that, but you're absolutely right. When we look at the process slide, we'll have the chance to show what a great piece of work the ISS team did, because they did make it dynamic. That was a key part to how their strategy ended up being so robust. The last thing we looked at was in the name of consistency as to how NASA themselves approached the CSCS option, we needed to see a demonstration of how the prime decision recommendation body would address the option of CSCS. And so we felt that it was important for the MMT to demonstrate that they actually followed through in execution on the things that were set on paper as far as considering this as a last resort and understanding all the inherent risks of actually choosing a CSCS option. If you're choosing this option anyway, you're already to the point where you've committed to throwing a space shuttle away. But there's more to the story than just that. There's the story of whether or not you understand the risks of committing nine people to living in an environment that was only certified for three at this point. So we wanted to make sure that the MMT basically understood the full scope of the risks that came along with this option, and a demonstration of that was important to us to make sure it was consistent from what was already envisioned as a concept all the way out to practice. Next slide. I'll quickly go through each of these conditions and show you where NASA ended up in detail. The condition number one, which is the explanation of the role CSCS played, basically it was reiterated, it is a viable but very limited emergency capability. If you are doing this, you have committed yourself to the fact that there is no other way to save the crew that's on the space shuttle, because the space shuttle has been compromised in some way, shape, or form through a TPS anomaly that does not allow for safe return through the atmosphere. And rather than commit them to basically something that doesn't give you a good end, the CSCS has been laid out there as an emergency capability as a last resort. So because it is expected that this particular option is extremely low probability, we think NASA did a good job of identifying what the limitations were as far as how far you would take the certification of this capability. As with many, many other aspects of the space shuttle, where we don't expect to find ourselves in certain scenarios, the CSCS falls in the category of something that's a low probability contingency, and the amount of work that was done as far as looking at it as more of a non-certified event as opposed to a certified event, we thought they did a good job of laying the boundaries for that, particularly in the context of how they placed it in their overall risk as far as only a mild mitigator. It's not a primary control for the hazard debris shedding. That obviously is on the tank. All the shuttle reserves and the ISS consumables may be depleted through the process of actually executing this. Again, you're in a scenario where it's life or death only, and if you want to save the lives of the crew, and that is the overdriving requirement, this is something NASA felt could be put out on the table as an option, and it's only applicable for the TPS anomaly. They did not try to take the CSCS option and extend it to other types of failures. And then finally, Susan's mentioned this already, but the CSCS decision will be made at the agency level because it is such an extreme decision. It is not something that's folded into flight rules necessarily. It's not something that's decided, certainly not outside the MMT at a lower level. It's something where the MMT actually comes together and recommends that this is the only way you could save the lives of the crew, and they would put that recommendation up to the MMT chair, who would raise it to a higher level to get it to the attention of the agency at large so that they could take the proper steps from that point on. Next slide. The analytic process, we felt, was extremely well done, and we really want to give kudos to the space station engineering team, ops team, and program team for coming up with something that was a very, very outstanding approach, we felt, in how they were actually coming up with the estimates for CSCS duration. One of the key things that they did was, as Jim mentioned, was to talk about the fact that this is not something where you just pick a number on any given certain day and expect that number to stick. The space station is a living, breathing, perhaps dynamically changing animal that ebbs and flows in terms of its consumable status. For example, right now, the oxygen consumption is dropping. The oxygen consumption, the crew on board right now, is consuming the oxygen that's available, and it's dropping down on a daily basis, and it'll get pumped back up with the arrival of a Progress in mid-June. But it really reiterates the point that the space station static view of consumables. It's got a very dynamic view of consumables. And so it was important, since you're talking about needing these consumables to carry an additional seven people on board, it was important that the analysis of looking at this was also dynamic. And the space station team did a great job of doing that. In the end result, when they came up with the duration for the CSCS, they did assume that you were going to run it all the way to zero. They did assume, based on their previous definition of the CSCS concept, they did assume that you could actually get to the point where the ISS crew themselves would also have to decrew because all of the consumables are gone. But the duration originally was done in such a way that you could perhaps, depending on certain circumstances, have a little bit of margin in that. And the ISS team that comes to the MMT is extremely well-versed on when you can and can't do that, and they bring that to the table. But the duration, when they say they've got 44 days of duration, for example, they do mean 44 days of duration, and perhaps more, depending on the circumstances. It could be extended through power downs, they believe. There is possibly some forward work that could be done as far as whether or not the crew is exercising. So those estimates have some reasonable assumptions about what the crew does and how the crew behaves when they came up with the duration. But those things also can be looked at if you needed to do a finer cut on whether or not you could extend the duration that they're currently putting forward as an estimate. Under the current duration estimates, oxygen is limiting consumable, but it should be noted that the carbon dioxide removal apparatus, the CEDRA, is an absolute requirement to getting out to the current estimates that they have on the books, which right now I believe at the last formal review was about 44 or 45 days. The FRR will be the next point where they come up with their next formal review. And even though we don't have the information on that yet, because there is a progress that arrives in mid-June that brings up more oxygen, the electron failure as it stands right now isn't necessarily a crisis. It is it's talking back to that dynamic way that the station ebbs and flows on its consumables, and the progress will certainly come back and bring oxygen on board when it arrives in mid-June. But the carbon dioxide removal apparatus is something that's necessary to the actual ability to take carbon dioxide out of the cabin atmosphere for 9 people. And right now it would need to operate for about 44 straight days if the estimate is 44 days. So they have decided as a result of that to manifest a couple of carbon dioxide removal apparatus spares on STS-114 so that in the event that there's a problem with that particular system, that you do have some reasonable spares on board that are basically lined up with some of the reasonable failures they expect they might see. So they've done, from the viewpoint of consumables for carbon dioxide removal, they have done a little bit of logistics planning that they didn't feel was necessary for some of the other systems. And we felt their approach was extremely reasonable based on the histories they've seen on the station systems. Next slide. The viable plan for launching a rescue vehicle, again, we've talked to the fact that we think that they've done that well. They actually have procedures that are in draft form for undocking a shuttle and then disposing of it and then bringing up another shuttle with a crew of 4. And so we think that they've looked at the whole approach of the launch on need. We do agree with them that this would be something that is definitely a higher risk launch than what you would call your standard shuttle launch, but it's certainly within the realm of the possible, and that's the kind of thing that we were after, was to make sure there was not some hardware or physical reason why you wouldn't be able to dispose of a shuttle and bring another shuttle up in order to foster a rescue. And they've done the look at that, and we do think that we agree with them that that is something that that is possible to do. The processing for the launch of the shuttle right now, the approximate duration for STS-300 is about a month. They are looking at different areas where they could possibly make that a little bit shorter. I think crew training was one of the areas they mentioned specifically in the last MMT, where they wanted to see if there was any margin in reducing the amount of processing time for STS-300 based on what the options are in the crew training arena. But definitely, if you're in this scenario, you do look at the fact that there is schedule pressure. The ISS CSCS duration does inherently give you only a limited amount of time to foster the rescue. And so it is recognized by the NASA community that this does, in fact, put pressure on the program, and therefore perhaps that is an increased risk where people are actually putting more thought to the schedule than you normally would for a shuttle launch. But they definitely have that site picture well under control, and they're definitely talking about that in the MMT when they go through the process of trying to figure out if this is an option they want to exercise. Next slide.
Susan, actually, I just have a question about launch rules for this kind of a launch. Do they suspend, rules of weather and other constraints that you would normally have in order to get this off the ground?
Well, they definitely know that they can do certain things and suspend certain rules they have in place for STS-114 if they needed to get the STS-300 up there before the end of the ability of the space station to sustain life. For example, the night launch. Right now we have a constraint against night launches because of the need to look at the debris shedding. But if you needed to do a night launch in order to get up there, that would be a rule, for example, that they would suspend. And they're looking at obviously through the MMT process and through, they're going to get a lot more help than just the MMT in a case like this, but they're going to be looking at a lot of those types of rules because it is a life or death situation that you're talking about, and you would, in fact, waive some of those things if it were necessary to make sure you got up there. The key part would be, of course, understanding the additional risk of doing those waived rules, but they absolutely recognize that that is something they would have to do.
Susan, what's the driver on the 1 month for STS 300?
Sorry?
What's the driver for the 1 month on STS 300?
In the MMT 13, it was stated that the 1 month, the reason it was 1 month and not something shorter, was the crew training template for STS 300 crew. And at the end of the MMT, Wayne Hale actually took an action to go and look into that. The processing, the way it was described in the MMT, that the 1 month is actually, if you were to take off the crew training constraint, you could launch somewhat shorter than perhaps the 33 days that were mentioned in the MMT. But it wasn't clear how much shorter, and it wasn't clear what the risk was of removing off some of the requirements for the crew training. So that was something that Wayne Hale gave someone as an action to go look at later. And we haven't seen the results of that.
It's launching off the same pad, I assume. We got to go back to the same launch pad.
Yes.
114.
But certainly, everybody is keyed to move expeditiously in the event that something like this were to occur. Next slide. The integration of CSCS into the launch process, again, I mentioned that CSCS is one of those things where this has not been part of any process to consider this. And so what we were looking for were to make sure that at the right points of synergy, the necessary information about CSCS and its relationship to STS 300 were on the table. And we were satisfied that, in fact, is the case, that again, there's a review that will come up to the FRR that describes all this in detail. And after the FRR, there will be basically at the L-2 and the L-1 day MMTs, the L-9-hour pre-tanking meeting, the final go-no-go poll at T-9. We don't have launch commit criteria related to this, which would automatically stop the launch, but we do have people out there asking the question and getting the status on whether or not things are as they were briefed at the FRR. It's become that the Electron has now failed today as opposed to failing within L-2 days or T-9 minutes or whatever. There was a thought that if the Electron failed sometime after FRR, that could have a somewhat significant impact on the CSCS duration, and you would need to revisit that. A CEDRA failure would be another example. But as we've basically gotten ourselves in a situation now where the Electron has already failed and we still show that we have reasonable duration estimates for the launch day of July 13th, we're already a little bit less worried that anything said at the L-2 or L-1 about CSCS durations is going to be of significance that would do anything to change the character of launching that day. So as we get closer in to an actual launch date, we're pretty sure that even though the information will be shared, it won't necessarily be of a significance that would impact the launch itself. Next slide. Finally, we wanted to make sure there was appropriate consideration of CSCS in the MMT process. And Susan has talked about this already. For us, we were looking to make sure that because it is the space station team that really has the sight picture on the risks and assumptions of the CSCS duration, they needed to really come to the table at the MMT and make sure that story was fleshed out appropriately so that all members could get the right kind of view on how risky this was. I think everybody at the MMT understood that by choosing CSCS, they were basically condemning an orbiter to be disposed of. But when you were talking about balancing whether or not to ride back that orbit on a tile repair, if you understood that CSCS may also have risks that could put the seven members, if not nine members of the crew, in danger, they needed to understand that as well. This is not something that is a certified capability. This is something where it's zero fault tolerant in many ways, and with one more failure, you could find yourself in a situation where the system would not be able to sustain nine people for a month, let's say. The analysis process does a great job of telling you that story, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't basically guarantee that duration. It just tells you, based on best estimates, what the duration could be in the absence of any future change to the state of the station. But the state of the station itself has several points of zero fault tolerance, particularly with respect to the carbon dioxide removal system, where you could find yourself in real trouble. And it is not something that you could necessarily bank on, and you need to know the risks of where those assumptions might fail. So the MMT was the best place to bring all that to the table. And on the MMT-13, we did see a robust discussion about all this. And so we were satisfied that as we walked away from the May MMT-13, that the overall MMT did have a really good appreciation. The ISS folks brought forward a briefing, which really helped their education on this. And they basically had the proper character to what the risks were when they discussed this option. Next slide. Through the process of going through all this, Amy and I had 13 data calls. NASA has presented a closure package to us that answers all of our data calls. And next slide. I've talked about the five conditions we were looking for. We feel like they met the intent of all five conditions as measured against their own implementation plan. So next slide. We feel like our assessment is complete, and their closure package is acceptable to us, and we would like to, at this point, recommend that the action be closed for the assessment of SSP 3. And after... Before we talk about that, I would like to, again, go back to an observation that the ISS program team, the ISS engineering ops and program team, did an absolutely outstanding job of raising the bar and then jumping over the bar that they raised. They, through the process of having a dynamic strategic review of what this capability would be and what its weaknesses are and its strengths, and the way they went around presenting this material to folks on the shuttle side who really were not witting of what the space station was capable of doing, we thought that they went well above and beyond what we would have expected just by looking at what the implementation plan said. So we want to really give some kudos to the ISS folks for doing that. Any questions?
Any questions? Well, I would like to comment on, since we took this on ourselves as an assessment item, was not one that we had defined in our charter because of it being a CABE recommendation. We didn't have the structure of what is it that we're trying to assess. I want to commend Susan and Amy Donahue for working that structure into place and saying, okay, this is what we really want to see for us to say that that we believe that contingency shuttle crew support as planned to be used as a risk mitigation capability makes sense, basically, and has met those wickets that we would consider to be proof that the right amount of planning and understanding and preparation to be able to consider its use had been done. And I think you guys did a wonderful job of that because we didn't give you the structure. We had a lot of other things to go work with. Any questions relative to the position that's been taken here? If not, unless there's objection, I'll recommend that we, based on the closure data submitted by NASA and the ops panel's presentation, any deliberation we've had today, The record reflects that task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the action that they undertook as SSP-3, and we'll accept the request that we close our assessment on this SSP-3 action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at this time, let me say that concludes the recommendation, the presentation of recommendations that we intend to present for closure today. We have one other recommendation that we would like to status the task group on, and that is what I like to refer to as the mother of all recommendations. It has bits of a lot of other CABE recommendations, and I think you'll see with this presentation why it's lingered till last for closure. And I'm going to turn the presentation of that status over to Dr. Kathy Thornton.